The name of our film is...
The Truth Is Out There.
But it really isn't.
Join Dean Haglund from The X-Files as he tries to learn what it means to search for the truth in a world where conspiracies or conspiracy theories are everywhere.
Nobody knows how to get out of the trouble we're in because nobody understands how it works.
And I can't learn it because...
You're never going to learn.
Unless I go to your website.
truth-is-out-there.com.
And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Hello, Dean Haglund.
Hello, Phil Lairness. How are you?
I'm doing excellent, and if what I'm seeing in front of me is real, we have excellent levels, and you're coming through fine.
I'm coming through fine, am I, Dimitri?
You know, in fact, last week was our first true intercontinental Chilpack Hollywood Hour, our first true trans-Pacific link-up. And
yeah.
And you know, if the rumors are true, and in show business the rumors are always true, you know that.
I do.
The show almost sounded too good to be Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Wow. Are you saying that my audio skills are whether giving us a bit of a hint of...
I'm thinking that maybe you moving and it forcing us to really buckle down, do some studying, do some preparation.
Oh, we can't half-ass it like we have the other ears.
May have, yeah, exactly. There was always the, you know, we hated it, but there was always the fallback of, oh, well, let's record it again.
That's right. Now we can't do that.
No, really, we really, really can't. Right. Hey, you know, speaking of last week's show and past episodes, you know what I thought was really funny?
What's that?
The two-part episode that we did, the special one that we pre-recorded and dropped a couple weeks ago, that was all about film literacy and the lost art of reading movies.
Right.
Not just following the plot, but reading their subtextual meaning, their symbolic meaning, their mythological resonance. We did a two-part episode all about that, and we demonstrated these skills by focusing on a revisitation of The X-Files, I Want to Believe.
Absolutely. And I got many an email saying how many people appreciated that and actually went to watch the movie again with these new levels of understanding.
Well, you know, Lily Holloman, of course, who was there with us, I don't know if you remember, she said that she would imagine some people would actually watch the movie with our show because it's about basically a two-hour movie. We did basically a two-hour show. It's almost like having an audio commentary track.
Hey, that's fascinating. We're sort of like Mystery Science Theater 3000, but with serious intent.
And very few laughs, really.
I laughed a lot.
And yet, we are trapped into doing this show, which explains why we are still doing it. But the thing
oh
that
my gosh,
the thing that
the metaphors,
I,
the metaphors.
The thing that I found so funny, though, and funny, maybe not humorous, maybe more I want to weep, is how many more people listened to episode 2 than episode 1. Episode 1, in which we lay out the skills that you need to truly reclaim a sense of literacy. Episode 2, far more people listen to that one, which explains really why we need episode 1.
So what you're saying is people jumped into the middle of the movie or started watching the movie and then listened.
People thought they could apparently just read the cliff notes.
Oh, clearly if you just listen to part 2, you'll get exactly the whole gist of it.
Oh, Hamlet. Hamlet's a classic depressive.
Come on. So easy.
Oh, so anyway, but I'm glad people are enjoying it. And it is funny because the numbers show that now people are starting to catch up on part 1. So, again, we don't care what order you do it. For all we know, these people actually, when they go to the movie, they go to the movies and they sit down halfway through a film. And then and then only then do they go back and watch the first half. So who knows?
You know, growing up as a kid, I was late to almost every movie, and it wasn't until I watched them on TV did I realize I missed the first 10 minutes on so many movies. I'm dying. I came in on Star Wars when R2 was in the valley with the Jawas hunting him down, and I thought that's how the movie started for the longest time.
What is this Star Wars of which you speak?
You know, there was a movie, now a bit of a franchise. Anyway.
I don't. The indies, you know, the low-budget indies. Another little, if what I read is true, then this would also be true. You celebrated a birthday this week.
I did. What you read is true. And it coincided with the announcement of the return of the gunman.
No, not really. So, it was a week later. A week later does not equal coincide.
Well, you're right. It does in my slow time frame.
Down under in the old west of where you live.
Exactly. Where the sundial tells us the time. Suddenly I had many more birthday wishes than I've ever had in any previous year and couldn't keep up with them all. So thanks everyone for the birthday wishes.
Was this a milestone birthday, Dean Haglund?
Well, they're all milestone birthdays, you know.
When you get to our age.
Exactly. Any day that you have a marathon of surviving.
The odds are against you. The odds are against you at this point. So
you know that it's a milestone.
How did we celebrate? Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can now.
Okay. I realized that I can hear you clearly because you're coming through the mixing board and into my speakers. And I can hear me because I'm holding a microphone. So I decided I could kick back and move away from the computers for a few minutes.
Uh-huh.
The problem being, you couldn't hear me.
Right. The batteries on my headphones died.
Ah, well, and also I was no longer near the microphone. This is not interesting at all to people. How did you celebrate?
Oh, so many ways, including a fantastic walk with the Dobermans to the Sydney Opera House for a sunny day photo shoot that'll be going up online, seeing the girls frolicking around the Sydney Opera House.
Who is this Sydney Opera House? I've never heard of him.
Never mind.
Oh, you know what? I've been watching the countdown to Jon Stewart's final show, and one of the final guests, concluding his massive worldwide publicity blitz in support of the film, was Paul Rudd. And Paul Rudd riffed on one of my favorite bits. You know how I always pronounce Spider-Man Spitterman, right?
That's
his last name. So he did this whole bit about how he's playing a character named Ant-Man. And he's a tailor, and he has the ability to cuff any pair of pants in 30 minutes or less. That's his superhero ability. It was really funny, and sadly, probably a movie you, Dean Haglund, would have enjoyed more than Ant-Man.
I think I did see Ant-Man, now that you mention it. It did seem like it was a lot of tailoring for no reason.
Oh, wow. See what I done did? Way too quickly. So you went for this walk. Now, was this the longest walk you'd taken yet with the girls there?
It was 14 kilometers, and it was through the urban core of downtown Sydney, which I didn't realize the girls missed so much. Out here in Newtown, it's a little more parks and single residents, but they went back downtown and loved it. So it was a fantastic walk.
That's great. Any other birthday celebrations we need to know about?
Well, I guess there will be one in Vancouver when I get there.
Oh.
I know. It's the birthday that just keeps on giving.
That's true. So I see what you're saying about the coincidence actually works out quite well, because everybody there, all your old friends and your family, your sister, your niece, yeah, get to celebrate your birthday with you in just a scant few days.
Exactly. Think of that.
I will think of nothing else. did you see the letter that I forwarded to you from our loyal listener, Agent Summer?
I did, and I was shocked to see that list of
That was the movies. This was a letter from Agent Summer that we promised to answer. So why don't I read that here to both to share it with our listeners and to jog your memory.
Very good.
Hello, Dean and Phil. I just came across some information on what warnings foreign governments give their citizens in travel to the U.S.
Right.
In particular, with Dean's new, hopefully temporary, residence, because she wants to see on the street. Let's face it. I wanted to point out what was said by the Australian government. It reads, like Australia, says the Aussie government, the U.S. enjoys, quote, strong people-to-people links. That sounds like a chain gang.
I know. So
we have a lot of people in prison, which I guess, you know, is fitting with the origins of Australia, and that's true. We have over 2 million Americans working on the chain gang right now. So, but maybe that's not what I mean. Thanks to the high flow of tourists, students, and long-term and professional workers, both to and from America and Australia, as a byproduct of this successful reciprocal relationship, America, now this italics is theirs, the entertainment superpower, is, quote, enriched by Australian actors, dancers, musicians, authors, and artists. A growing number of Australians in the entertainment industry are taking on starring and supporting roles on American movie and television screens, with many winning awards. Agent Summer goes on to write, since both of you have traveled the globe, I'm curious to get your take on how other countries view the U.S., which can certainly factor into how the U.S. culture is portrayed in foreign films. Of course, right, it would be interesting to hear Dean's views on the Aussie view in particular. I personally believe we're enriching their culture by loaning them one of our national treasures, the talented actor, artist, comedian, and podcaster, Mr. Dean Hagland. Thank goodness we still have the wonderful Phil Larenas to hold down the Chilpack Nation in the U.S. Wow, this is the first time I think we've ever heard the phrase Chilpack Nation, and I may be beating that into the ground in the weeks to come.
With a shuddering terror.
Take care, and as always, thanks for all you do, your loyal listener, Agent Summer. Dean Hagland, take it away.
Fantastic. Well, having been here now and performed both live and on camera, there is not a marked difference, but definitely there's a difference in working style, similar to their phrase, no worries, mate, as they say. It seems that there's a lot less angst and or slash, dare I say, pretension when people in the arts approach their work. So
do they expect someone then, since the purpose of this question is how are, I guess, Americans viewed, do they expect a certain level of pretension on your part? I mean, I know they know probably that you're from Canada, but I mean, having been part of Hollywood and having been working in Los Angeles for so long, does that mean they expect you to have a certain level of pretension or affectation?
Yeah, Well, they do, first time, you know, there seems to be that sort of apprehension, like, oh no, is he going to be difficult to work with? Is he going to be, you know, full of demands? He wants his own, you know, Perrier water soaked in coconut oil or whatever. And then when, of course, they see me and that's not the case, then everybody sort of chills out. So I suppose I'm feeling that, but nobody's expressed it outright.
Well, that's interesting. When I was thinking about this email, I was thinking about how the interactions I've had, whether it's been 12 years ago working on a documentary film in Brazil or touring parts of the UK shooting and then later showing, you know, or Europe shooting and showing, Truth is Out There. One of the constant things that I'm thrust up against is how much the rest of the world knows about what's going on here versus really, for the most part, America not seeming to have a lot of interest in what's going on elsewhere.
Right. I don't know if it's about interest. I think it's the way the media is distributed. Because here, the distribution, you know, it's funny. We got a DVR box from the phone, cellular phone service we signed up with. And you plug that box in, and there's no local Australian channels that you can get off this DVR box. So all we're watching is a sci-fi channel, CNN, and then there's some BBC and some French news channels. But for the most part, they're American channels coming in on an Australian cable box.
Okay, so let's, following up on what you said about the working environment then, and right. then going, so going micro to macro, right. entertainment to politics, and we know, of course, that there's always, sadly, altogether too many similarities between entertainment and politics, but in the workplace, it's always struck me that Americans, you know, you don't want to generalize, but for the most part, we're not going to work on jobs in other parts of the world expecting to learn how they do things. We tend to expect that, if anything, they're going to need to learn how we do things.
Yes, that's the general generalization.
And so, therefore, the expectation on the part of the people you were working with that you might bring certain demands. Yes, maybe the personal affectations of the Perrier and these sort of things, but couldn't it also be, you know, you have a certain expectation of how many people are going to be there handling props or how many people are going to be available for your wardrobe or how many, you know, just like, well, this is the way a set works in America.
Right. Right.
And I don't think necessarily, I think there's this attitude, an American attitude of, hey, it works for us, so it works. We're going to bring the benefit of our knowledge to you. Is that a fair assessment of my people?
Yeah, I think so. You know, there was, when Fox built their studio, this is an example, Fox built their studio here for the second Mission Impossible movie.
Oh, yes, when. Yeah, the John Woo one, yeah.
The okay. John Woo one, and that was shot here in Sydney in the outlying areas. And I was, of course, at Fox talking to executives back then, and they all had a big laugh because they, requested a studio. When they got there, there was only one electrical outlet in the entire studio. A massive, and they were like, well, we got to plug in lights and stuff. And they go, yeah, right there in that electrical outlet. And so there was this engineering mentality that was quite laughable in the U.S. And they had to demand, no, you put outlets all over the studio so we can plug in lights anywhere we need. And, you know, clearly they weren't used to that idea of like, oh, we're just going to light this studio with 1,000 lights and you're going to have one electrical socket. That was it. So that was a laughable example of how the executives couldn't wrap their head around the engineering skills and had to go in and say, no, this is how we want it done, and this is how the studio is going to be built. And now I understand all the studios are built like that. But at the time in the 90s, that wasn't the case. So there's an example of bringing in the American way of doing things and laughing about it when it's not done that way.
Right, right. Well, I don't know what the half-life is on this kind of thing, but I do urge caution for you when you're out going on these long walkabouts with the dogs, because I'm pretty sure that unless you breathe carefully, you are still going to be able to inhale the stink from Mission Impossible 2 that was shot there.
Yeah, you know, I thought that was the carbon monoxide from the cars, but I think it is Mission Impossible 2.
It's
palpable.
The thing that drives me nuts, and yes, this is not entirely, the populace's to blame, though it's ultimately our responsibility. It's always our own education is always our own responsibility, obviously. Yeah. It's not someone else's responsibility to educate us. But there has always been a rather shocking amount of surprise on the part of people I encounter in other countries that I either know what I know about their particular political system, their political state, their their current circumstances, because what they are used to is a complete lack of knowledge about how their part of the world works, and also a lack of interest. And the truth is, here in you go to other countries. Look, I was in Brazil watching the coverage live of President George W. Bush's second inauguration. You know, that was covered live on all their networks in Brazil, in Portuguese, right? And we don't even cover foreign elections here. We're a year and several months away from the next presidential election, and our news cycle every day is dominated. We haven't even started the primaries yet. And our news cycle is dominated every day by election news for 2016. What's going on in Greece? Germany basically owning Greece. We don't get any coverage of that. You know, elections around the world, none of it. And I think why it plays. And you're right that it's the media is not giving us anything else. But also, there isn't really that much demand either that I'm hearing for it, because I think it plays into a certain comforting sense that, okay, if we're not the most powerful nation in the world, or if we're not truly isolationist, we're still the single most important country in it. And
we're just fascinating to ourselves.
Yeah, and so I think it... You know, look, learning about things, especially when you don't have a big base of knowledge to begin with, is scary. It makes you feel almost overwhelmed by how much you don't know. So it's sometimes safer to stay in ignorance. That's why we say ignorance is bliss, right?
Well, true. And at the same time, there's a cost factor, too, to send out reporters to all parts of the world and then bring everybody up to speed on the context and then report on the story. A massive amount of resources needed for that. And, you know, so you build these massive CNN and Fox News distribution channels, and then you don't have the money to send out a ton of people around the world to cover stuff. So basically, you just look out the window in New York and just start talking about whatever's going on in the nation.
And that would be all right, I suppose, if it were simply a matter of entertainment and media and what the populace here in this country is paying attention to, knows, doesn't know. But the truth is, we can't ignore any longer that it is the government here as well that doesn't have often a basic understanding of what's going on around the world and how things fit in. This recent deal with Iran, over their nuclear program. Prime Minister Netanyahu in Israel says not too long ago that by the end of next year, by next summer of 2016 or whatever at the latest, Iran's going to have a nuclear bomb, right? So a deal gets negotiated and put into place that pushes that back at least 8, 10, 15 years. And immediately, it is roundly dismissed by so many corners of elected officials here because it has supposedly now put Iran on the track to obtain a nuclear weapon that they were only a year away from getting anyway. Now they're 10, 15 years, but everybody dismisses it roundly. Now, I'm not saying it's a good deal. All I'm saying is it's roundly dismissed, and by the admission of all the people who roundly dismissed it, they did so without bothering to read the deal.
Right.
And you know, I saw interview after interview of people both supporting and dismissing the deal, and none of them had read it. You know, our elected officials don't actually do their research.
Right.
They're not prepared. They're not prepared. Well, and that's the problem then with the fourth estate to me, the news media. That's where they're letting down, because it's not so much, I guess, you're right, that the populace, if the populace doesn't care to be informed about what's going on in the rest of the world, that's actually their right. They don't have to. And yeah, there's a degree to which these global media companies are giving the people what they want. On the other hand, don't they have a responsibility to hold the people in power and authority responsible to the people they serve? And if they're not actually reporting the stories of what's going on in the rest of the world, how can they turn around and hold the government responsible for what's going on in other parts of the world?
Well, and this is where now you separate journalism from infotainment. And I think so many of these 24-hour news cycle things now regard themselves as infotainment, that they abdicate their responsibility, whatever they had as journalists long ago.
This is an interesting topic that could, not funny and not an entertaining topic. It's an interesting topic, though, and one that, you know, maybe we can revisit from time to time. We'll be on the lookout for this as a theme. We'll call it either what other countries know about us or what America doesn't know about you. That could be fun. But let's point out right now, if you're listening to this show, it's because you're a citizen of the Chilpack Nation. And as a citizen of the Chilpack Nation, you are an international citizen of the world.
Absolutely. That's how it works now.
Hey, I mentioned, of course, that Jon Stewart's run is ending on The Daily Show.
Yes.
That's really, I mean, it is the end. I mean, his service, we've talked about so much before. I mean, he really served a function that went above and beyond entertaining people on a daily basis. Hell, entertaining people on a daily basis is hard enough.
Right.
And he and his team pulled that off. But boy, he did something far more important, and probably something he never knew was really going to be his job when he signed up for it.
Right. And the idea of putting news in context. This is the amazing thing that I always think they did, is that, you know, they would go back and they would research C-SPAN and see where some stupid congressman said the exact opposite thing not 5 years earlier.
Yeah.
And just show that, you know, side by side, and you get ironic laughter. It was like one of the first shows to have irony, basically.
And you know, I mean, we've talked about this before. So often, you'll hear usually people who have been criticized by The Daily Show referring to them as some sort of liberal show. Meanwhile, we find out, of course, that President Obama actually called Jon Stewart to the White House twice within the last year to basically call him out on being an asshole and on being responsible for making the populace jaded. So much for being a liberal mouthpiece. But anyway, as we've talked about so many times before, really, his target and their target was the news media itself, and holding the news media's feet to the fire for not doing their job. And when they would show the hypocrisy or the idiocy of something political, it was almost always tied in with this point: how come the people who are paid to do this job are not doing it, i.e.
Right.
holding politicians' feet to the fire?
Why are the comedians doing that?
Why are the comedians doing it? Yeah. But even as Jon Stewart leaves, which, you know, does hold for me a little bit of sadness and a little bit of fear, because, you know, will Trevor Noah be able to carry that torch? And if not, who will stand up to do it? Because it is clearly needed. At the same time, so exciting that Art Bell is returning to the airwaves.
Yes.
In, I guess August, probably. And
yes.
I mean, for those who maybe are in the Chilpack Nation, who are either too young or who lived on other shores and weren't able to enjoy Art Bell. Can you describe the genius of Art Bell a little bit?
Well, Art Bell had a late night 4-hour show, I believe it was, back before George Norrie on Coast to Coast. For those in the paranormal UFO conspiracy world, we know George Norrie as to be the guy who has the guests, who have the information that you don't get through other regular media outlets.
Alternative thought.
And while George Norrie is a great host, I think, and he does a good job, Art Bell seemed really personally invested in a lot of these stories. And he went off the air amid some controversy, but is now back and ready to go at it again. So I think this is going to be pretty exciting. And if I'm reading my email correctly, I think there might be a little appearance by him. Me and you on that show.
Well, at the very least, you. At the very least, Dean Haglund will not only be returning to The X-Files, he will also be returning to Art Bell in September to talk about all things truth-related. And indeed, we opened this show, of course, with a little 30-second spot promoting our epic documentary of comedy, consciousness, and conspiracy, The Truth Is Out There. And people can learn more about that at truth-is-out-there.com.
So easy.
We're working on a sequel, Truth Is Out There, Ancient Mysteries, and I'm sure you'll talk about that when you're on with Art Bell. So I can't wait. That'll be great fun, and we'll hit,
that's in September, right?
That's in September, and we'll hit people to that date as it approaches. Now,
yeah, my email's really full, so I'm losing all of these dates on me.
Okay.
September. Thanks, Phil.
So last week we promised we would do something that actually harkened back to 2 weeks ago when Lily Holloman and Karen Foreman, the co-hosts of the forthcoming Am I Right Ladies, guest hosted for us. And they talked about this organization called Film Fatales. And these are female filmmakers who have banded together and now have 15 chapters around the world. And they issued two lists. The first was recent women-directed films that everyone should see, and the other was women-directed films that inspired the work of Film Fatales. And what you and I said we would do is we would go through the list, talk a little bit about the movies we had seen, and then thereafter we would, each of us taking turns, would bring to the discussion one female-directed film from this list each week that we would analyze and hopefully celebrate if we enjoyed it. Now, you looked at the list of recent women-directed films, and had you seen any of them?
I saw one.
I had seen only two, actually. What was the one that you had seen?
Monsoon Wedding.
No, that's of the all-time list. That's the one of the list of the films that inspired the work of Film Fatales.
Okay, then I saw none.
None. So you didn't see Selma, the last year's JFK.
JFK.
No. Wait a minute. So this is, here I am talking about Americans don't know what's going on in the rest of the world, and I didn't know that there was a difference between MLK and JFK.
That is tough.
They were both rabble-rousers. Okay.
Yeah. MLK, no. Martin Luther King
Jr.
biopic, I guess.
Yeah.
Selma, I did not see. I was expecting to see it, and somehow the timing didn't work out.
Okay. Well, that was one of only two that I saw, and it was very well directed. I mean, as I spoke of at the time when it came out, you know, you have to put up with certain things like Oprah Winfrey turning up because she financed it, and you know that when you have Oprah in scenes, sometimes kind of shoehorned into scenes, you're not directing those scenes the same way you would otherwise, because Oprah's going to get privileged. And
holy smokes, she's coming here for a personal tour. Tickets are $2,500 each.
Wow.
I know. And as someone said, there better be a house under my chair.
So you mean she's coming to take a personal tour from Dean Haglund, the historic core walking tour of downtown Sydney.
Personally touring Sydney, Australia.
Oh.
And charging and having some sort of event where it's $2,500 to sit there and listen to her.
The other one that I saw here was from Ama Asante, and it was the story Belle, which came out also, I think, maybe last year or the year before. And it was about colonial era and, you know, a woman of mixed heritage who gets adopted, I guess, by her grandfather, who are landowners. And it's about the plight that she faced as a free woman of color, still how, you know, how limited her choices were in her life. And a movie that I really wanted to like, a movie that really cared about what it was doing. And something that I have less and less patience for at this point as a storyteller, which is, you know, characters are no different than real people, right? We all have many things going on in our lives. And so sometimes it's a little bit of folly how much import is given to every single scene. Because in our lives, right, only rarely do we appreciate that we are in the midst of an important moment while it's happening. It's only looking back that we realize, wow, that was really a turning point in our lives.
Right.
And this is a movie that plays every, you know, the stakes are so, they're played so high every single scene. And and it really wears me out. You know, I want more of a sense of wherever the time and the place is, I want to know how these people live. I want to get a feel for it, you know?
Yeah. So you have some scenes that aren't of dramatic tension, as it were.
Well, you've got to let real life in no matter what the stakes are. Otherwise, okay. You know, it's just highly theatrical in a way that I don't mean as complimentary. You know, I don't mean like a stage play. I mean just highly stylized melodrama. So
right. But bringing this back to female directors, like I've worked on many a TV show with a female director, and the process is the same. I mean, you know, you set up your shots, you hear the actors do their things, you make adjustments, but...
First of all, you said you've done TV shows with female directors, and rarely does a director have a lot of power in television. Rarely.
Sure.
Because if it's episodic, the writers and the actors do. But as I'm sure you'll remember from the discussion that led into this on your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour 2 weeks ago, there are real obstacles standing in the way of women being even allowed to do the same job men are, even
Absolutely.
Once they are hired. And one of these things is the babysitter complex, where apparently almost always women have assigned to them male superiors to supervise them in all decision-making meetings.
Oh.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah. So it's tough. And also the lack of mentoring that goes on. You know, there's the mini-me, phenomenon among male directors, right? Like, Phil, do you want to direct this? No, I'm not available to direct this, but you know who you should get? You should get so-and-so. And the odds are I'm telling you to get so-and-so because he reminds me of me. And
that's right. And he's a young me.
He's a young me, or he's a less expensive me. Yeah. Anyway, so what was the one on the Monsoon Wedding was the one on the historic list of female directed movies that inspired the work of Femme Fatale, and it's a great one. Monsoon Wedding is one of my favorites.
Yes. And of course I saw that way back in the 90s and when it first came out. And of course I can't now even remember all the details of it, other than it was beautifully shot.
Yes.
Fantastically.
Mira Nair. Yeah, Mira Nair, who has another film, Salaam Bombay, on there, which I can't wait to see. But let me ask you this then. So you never, I'm not raking you over the coals. I'm going to mention the ones that I've seen, because the most of these are fairly well known that I saw. But you never saw American Psycho. That surprises me.
Yeah, no, I never saw it because the book sort of I found not distasteful, just rather I wasn't pleased with the book when I read it, so okay. The movie didn't really appeal to me.
I just thought, as you know, potentially a dark comedy, that might have been something that appealed to you. Now, what about Boys? Yeah. What Boys Don't Cry, the Oscar-winning film starring Hilary Swank?
Oh, dang! I did see that one too.
Yes,
I forgot.
Of
yes.
course,
okay,
you did.
So two.
And that's seminal. I mean, that is, you know, if you can call a film important, that was important. I mean, that, I think, did go a way to change some hearts and minds over people who face certain kind of gender identification issues.
Absolutely. And totally gripping. And Hilary Swank in her performance, that was spellbinding, really.
Of course, one of the classics of early indie cinema. Or not early indie cinema, because as we know, that goes back to the 40s. But what we think of like 80s, 90s, Gas Food Lodging from Allison Anders.
Right. Now, was that the one with the German, she was a German tourist in a gas station off the main highway?
Wait, aren't you thinking of, wait, wasn't that the cafe, the Baghdad cafe? Or am I getting those confused now?
I think you're getting those two confused.
Well, then you.
Gas Food and Lodging.
Okay, well, then you have seen it.
Yeah, but I don't think I saw the whole thing, though. I saw the first 20 minutes of it and then thought, oh, okay, and then I was going to watch the rest of it and never did.
Well, and I was also surprised that you hadn't seen Near Dark, Catherine Bigelow's vampire film starring Lance Henriksen.
I know. That shocked me, too. I don't know how that went off my radar, but that has not crossed my...
And that's why Lance Henriksen was sitting in front of me at the red carpet premiere for Catherine Bigelow's Zero Dark Thirty. He was there to support his old director.
Oh, my gosh. And Lance Henriksen and I sit beside each other quite often at the Long Beach Comic Book Expo, as in the same booth where he's signing his book, Pretty Good for a Human.
That's outstanding. Well, okay,
yes, well,
so here are some, and I've talked about these on the show. Here are some of the ones that I've seen, all of which I strongly recommend. Sarah Pauley's recent documentary, Stories We Tell, which made my top 10 list for that year.
Oh, yes.
Is just such a beautiful, beautiful piece of work. Miranda July, I think, is nothing less than a national treasure. And she did a fantastic indie movie that really kind of helped people discover John Hawkes as a leading man, Me and You and Everyone You Know. It's such an odd and really affecting and charming romantic comedy. I really enjoyed, back from the 90s, High Art, which everybody thought was going to be a comeback for Ali Sheedy, who is very interesting in it, but instead it was the breakout for Patricia Clarkson.
Oh.
And it's a wonderful character drama. I also really enjoy the kind of nasty comedy, But I'm a Cheerleader, which starred Natasha Lyonne, who was really such a promising newcomer when she first appeared on the scene. Got into some trouble, but now, of course, is back and doing well with Orange is the New Black. So those are the ones that... Oh, and also, finally, I really loved, as you know, one of my top 10 for the year it came out, Wendy and Lucy by Kelly Reichardt, starring Michelle Williams. As a woman living in her car who is on a search for her dog that went missing, and it's just so heartbreaking.
It is heartbreaking. I don't think I did start watching that, and I then turned off the TV and hugged my dogs. So
we will look at this list, and I'll start, since you're going to be traveling this week, and then and then we'll assign one from the list for you to the following week.
Fantastic.
Before we move on to your travels a little bit, I did see two films that are just coming out here in the States, both of which I can recommend thoroughly. The first is Bill Condon, the writer-director of Gods and Monsters, has reteamed with his Gods and Monsters star Ian McKellen to do a Sherlock Holmes film called Mr. Holmes.
Not John Holmes, the porn star, as you mistakenly.
No, that was an understandable mistake on my part. Sherlock Holmes in towards the very twilight of his life. And it is less a mystery, though there are mysteries involved. It is less a mystery and more a rumination on how identifying so closely with one's, albeit celebrated, intellect, what does that do for someone's long-range emotional health to be so closely identified with the intellect? And it's a really, really wonderful performance by Ian McKellen, and just a lot. I had so much fun with this movie.
Oh, fantastic.
And the other one is from James Ponsoldt, the first screenplay to be written by Donald Margulies, the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright, who, among other things, wrote a juicy role for Lily Holloman in Coney Island Christmas when it premiered at the Geffen. He wrote his first screenplay. It's the adaptation of the book about Infinite Jest authors David Foster Wallace's book tour, as witnessed by journalist and author David Lipsky. They spent a few days together because Lipsky was supposed to be doing a profile on Wallace for the Rolling Stone. And this is an account of what happened during those days.
And so it's a screenplay based on a book about a book tour as witnessed by a Rolling Stone.
A screenplay based on a book based on something like 80 hours of audio cassettes that recorded the entire days that they spent together. And Lipsky wrote the book after Wallace killed himself. And it's called The End of the Tour. It stars Jesse Eisenberg in the Jesse Eisenberg role. And, there is a degree to which, yes, you're a very fine actor. We're seeing you just do your Jesse Eisenberg stuff again and again, only with different wigs now.
Yeah.
But as David Foster Wallace, and playing an artist and trying to make the mind of the artist not only accessible, but interesting to people who are not artists, is almost a task that seems impossible, usually, for Hollywood to pull off. But this David Foster Wallace is not just someone who is believably the author of Infinite Jest, but someone that you really, really want to spend these hours with and wish you could spend more time with. And Jason Segel, I won't say he's never been good. Of course, he's been good before. He's been funny. He's been successful before. But this is the first time he's relevant. That's how good he is as David Foster Wallace. It's really a great performance. And there aren't enough films with two really thoughtful, intelligent, heartfelt people speaking to each other. And the conversations are fascinating.
Wow. And so is this action-packed in any way, or is it just My Dinner with Andre times 11?
Well, it's action-packed in the sense that they go on the book tour. I mean, look, hey, if you think our documentary, The Truth Is Out There, is action-packed, then, oh my goodness, this is Mission Impossible Rogue Nation.
Well, then, that's exactly how I...
So those are my recommendations for films just released that people should check out. Mr.
Excellent.
Holmes and The End of the Tour. Now, you are, when do you get on a plane? Well, of course, this is Monday, so you're already there.
Yes, exactly. I've arrived as I'm speaking.
All right.
I've just had a 14-hour flight, and I'm refreshed.
Oh, well, thank goodness. So, The Lone Gunman, returning to the X-Files, have you now read the script?
Yes.
But that sounded like... And when I say I mean I had someone read it aloud to me while I got a massage.
Yes, I had my dogs read it while I got a massage. They just barked it out in an acty play way. So, no, I have read the script. There's some revisions that came in the email that I haven't read. So I've read an early version of it.
And which episode is this?
Well, I suppose it's the fourth.
Okay.
But I'm not sure about that, actually.
Right. But initially, you had thought that it was the final episode, which didn't seem to make sense to me based on their shooting schedule. So I was... Some of us have been paying attention to how much they've been shooting and looking at what leaks from the set. So I had thought that this was probably the fourth episode. So that's...
Right. And then I got emails from friends saying they're auditioning for The X-Files and their shoot dates are later in August. So that's how I was a clued in on that.
And, you know, I read an interview. It was very kind. Chris Carter went to Scandinavia for a fantastic film a film festival that focuses on fantastic, you know, movies, not fantasy films per se, but I think that's the going way to describe, you know, science fiction and horror and fantasy altogether is fantastic film. And he went to support it. That's a long trip on a weekend when you're in the midst of shooting. But he, you know, nice guy that he is, obviously, he didn't want to back out on them because when he had confirmed for it, it was before, you know, the reboot had been authorized, and so he didn't want to back out. So he went, and I read an interview with him there, and you know, he seems really kind of gung ho about the idea that look, they'll be back again next year making more of these episodes.
Yeah, well, that seems to be the case. I suppose it's who's financing it and who still wants to carry on doing it.
But I mean, I ask you not because you have any insight into, you know, Fox or the distribution deal or any of that, but does any of that come across in the writing that, boy, this doesn't feel like something that is being put to bed? Or does it feel like something that's being put to bed?
No, it definitely does not. It reads just like you said, there was a 13-year commercial break and now we're back at it. And it doesn't seem to be trying to resolve anything, dealing with new issues, new characters come in. It definitely has not a let's all hug and go home send off, but more this is as pertinent as ever. And this quest for the truth is more important than ever before.
Terrific. When are your shooting dates for this episode?
Well, I guess I don't actually know because they moved it. Originally, I was supposed to be there last week.
Right.
And would have made it easy. But now I land Monday and I leave Wednesday. So I shoot somewhere in those days.
Well, I would bet that would be Tuesday.
Tuesday and or Monday.
Well, I mean, are they allowed to? I didn't think they were allowed to put you to work on the day you land.
I land Sunday, though.
Well, now, see, you're changing your story. Of course, I have no idea what day it is for you, where you are, or what century you're in.
Nor do I. It's archaic.
And what about any hint on locations? Like, do you know? Are you going to be on a practical location? Are you going to be on a soundstage? Because you were kind enough to drive me around one time in Vancouver and show me some of the you know many locations. The old bank, the old insane asylum, and so do you even know anywhere that you might be? Or
no, I haven't even seen I think they sent a one sheet, but all it said was Maple Ridge, which is a community outside of Vancouver. But there's studios there, and there's practical locations there. So it didn't go into that kind of detail. And I frankly don't need that kind of detail because I'm just going to be picked up and whisked away in a car and show up smiley faced and not jet lagged.
But on this one, you are going to demand your Perrier.
I am. Yeah. The one thing that was non-negotiable, Perrier with coconut
well,
water.
Well, you've always told the story about how you regretted that you didn't, throw the bats around in a baseball coaching parlance. You didn't throw a tantrum on the set of The Lone Gunman. So I certainly hope you're taking advantage of this opportunity.
Just to throw, I think it's more important when it's your series to do that than when you're just a day player.
Yeah. I see. Yeah, the reason I do it every couple episodes on Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
That's right. So I could talk you out of the trailer so we can get the show recorded.
What? So two final questions that I'll hit you with, and then I'll, of course, ask you the next time we speak about the experience you have there. Well, I guess three questions. So they're shooting you on Tuesday. Are you really leaving on Wednesday and heading back to Australia?
Yeah. Well, I definitely.
So you're just not really going to get much of a chance, much family time or anything while you're there?
No, that's jammed in on Sunday as I land.
Wow.
I know, right?
But so I must say, I've been saying this to people, and, all this crazy travel you're doing, and I've known you to do crazy, crazy travel before, and I've known it to take a lot out of you, but there is something, the combination of the travel with what you're doing right now, but when you came through L.A., I've known you now almost like we're more than 15 years, going on 20. And this was as young as I'd ever seen you look. and that, granted, that was a month ago, and there's been a lot of travel since then.
Right,
but I've seen the photos of you, and you look the picture of health. And this is amidst all that travel and returning to a really inclement winter there. And so you're dealing with a lot of different climate changes, which is not an easy thing. So somehow this travel binge is bringing out the best in you.
Well, thank you, sir. I had no idea that was doing it. I'm maybe feeling it a bit in my left knee, but other than that, I agree with your assessment.
So
sitting on my ass for 14 hours makes me young. I don't know.
I guess it does.
That doesn't seem right.
So we're winding out of time, but I would be remiss if I didn't hit you with these two probing questions first.
Okay.
In what you've read, and since they brought this up, all of a sudden, which is how you said it always would happen, because that's how they've always written the gunmen. What are the chances that they do end up saying, "Hey, Dean, we need you back here for a day for episode 5 or 6.
I'm saying, let's say 50-50.
Wow. Okay, yeah. So there is that possibility.
There is that possibility.
So you have to be prepared for that. And then the final probing question for now, what's the latest about wigs?
I think I got a wardrobe fitting on that Monday. And that probing question will be answered then.
Nobody has nobody brought it up.
No, they asked my head size. You know, is your head big or small or large? That was about it. One email.
So they do plan on having you with the long hair again.
I don't know if that's what that was referring to, or if I'm wearing a hat, or if they just want to know, you know, where my ego at. How big's your head, mister?
I think it's probably that. I think it's probably that one.
Right.
You know, we didn't get to any of our categories that we usually do, but I do want to remember, and I'll remember him by just playing a little bit of a clip at the end. But wrestling great Rowdy Roddy Piper left us.
Yeah.
And I really want to remember him because he has one of my all-time favorite lines in any movie ever. In John Carpenter's They Live. So I'll tag that on to the very end of the show. But let me play this little celebrity death sting so that I can get your feedback on Cecil the Lion.
Oh.
Celebrity deaths.
Have you been following this story at all, Dean Hagland?
Have we indeed?
I would expect that there was probably a great deal of reaction there. For people who don't know, and these would probably only be Americans, Cecil the Lion is a very famous lion, 13 years part of a study and that was gaining great publicity. And he was
favored on all the tours, on the safari tours in Zimbabwe.
A part of an Oxford University study, this dentist by the last name of Palmer hired two Zimbabwe nationals to help him hunt and kill this lion. He did issue an apology and saying that he didn't know that the lion was collared and part of a study until the end of the hunt. And when he says the end of the hunt, that's an interesting euphemism, as is kill, because they slow killed this animal. They stalked it and hunted it and slow killed it. Am I wrong? And they skinned it before it was dead, right?
And, oh, I didn't read that.
And, of course, beheaded it. So I don't know. You know, I always want to obviously appeal to the best in people. So my response in hearing the dentist issue an apology is go fuck yourself with your apology. And I don't take the side of Mia Farrow, who apparently published this guy's home address on Twitter. That's going to get a whole lot of crazies to his door. I don't think that's fair. I think just, I don't know, give a whole bunch. I don't know, just have a lion or two show up at his door. That I would be all right with.
Yeah, that's karmic justice. I mean, hunting for sport. You know, we had a science teacher, and he would hunt deer in Canada with a bow and arrow. But he would take days. It would be by himself. He would learn, you know, it'd be a lot of science attached to it. And he would also eat the meat and, you know, use the animal. And it was like a relationship. This thing of just baiting an animal to get it out of the reserve, and then you shoot an arrow but don't kill it cleanly, so it's maimed and walking around. All of these things are not hunting or even sports hunting, which is also a horrible term. And I, you know, it's reprehensible no matter what way you try couch it.
Yeah, hunting for sport. I mean, it isn't sporting in the least because the odds are completely stacked in your favor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And particularly when you are luring the animal out of a protected reserve.
Yeah, it is. It is. You know, I watched a Fritz Lang movie called Manhunt. And it was Walter Pidgeon. It was filmed before the war and then released in 1941. And it was about a British captain who was a famous explorer who goes on a sporting stalk that he actually is sport hunting, and he's sport hunting Adolf Hitler. And so they believe, the Germans believe, that he's there to assassinate Hitler. And he explains when he's caught, no, I could have killed him if I wanted to. It's a sporting stalk. And they said, what do you mean? He says, well, you don't, if you're sporting, you don't kill the animal. Where's the sport in that?
Right.
It's not a sport, well, then. That's killing.
Yeah.
There's a difference between hunting and sport. Hunting for sport is a contradiction in terms, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, and sports fishing is catch and release. You know, that's a thing where you don't, you know, eliminate the volleyball players or you never play volleyball again. So.
Well, that's a euphemism I'm going to spend the rest of the week dissecting. And that does bring us to an end of another exciting episode of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. Why don't I let you go, Dean, and I'll button this thing up.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, Phil. We'll see you next week.
Everyone in Chill Pack Nation can enjoy every single episode of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour at chillpackhollywood.com, chillpackhollywood.com. You can download them, you can stream them, you can subscribe via iTunes, thanks to our good friends at Blog Talk Radio. You can also enjoy the latest episodes at fanboynation.com. Your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour is brought to you by the good folks at Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Like us on Facebook, won't you? Facebook.com/ChillPackHollywood. And follow us on Twitter. We are at Dean and Phil. Until next week, I'm Phil Lernis. Thanks for listening. Intercontinental LA to Australia. Belated spoiler alert. Oh.
I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
Oh, shit.